So let's read Revelation chapter 2. We'll read verses 8 through 11. And to the angel of the church at Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last, who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, though you are rich, and your slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you in prison, that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death.
Dealing with the second of seven churches that Jesus wrote to in the second and third chapter of Revelation. This one dealing with the church, particularly in Smyrna. This is the second of seven short letters written to these seven churches in seven different cities, all of them in the area of Asia Minor, part of the Roman Empire at that time. These churches were all under the control of Caesar Domitian. If you do any studying about that individual, history tells us that he was quick-tempered and treacherous. He saw himself as the absolute. This was a man, a very egotistical man. He took pleasure in being called God. He also renamed two of the 12 months after himself. You know that you have a real problem with an ego if you start naming time after yourself, but he did. He had an image that was kept in the temple, Rome, probably a marble bust of some sort. And with that image was an altar. And every year, citizens were required to come to the temple, Rome, in Smyrna and burn incense on that altar and bow their knee before that image of Caesar Domitian and confess him as their Lord. Now, there were Christians in Smyrna, we know that. And it goes without saying that this activity, this annual coming to the altar, a pagan temple, to bow your knee before a marble image and pay homage, confessing a man as your Lord, would have violated the conscience of the Christians that were there, as it would do to any Christian anywhere. So they simply wouldn't do it. Sometimes Christians have to make a decision on whether they're going to follow through with something that the rest of the world expects of you, even if it would violate your conscience. So they ran into a problem there, didn't they? The problem was that by refusing to comply with the government expectations, they were going to be denied the documentation that would have been provided to those who were willing to comply with this annual form of pagan worship. They got a certificate of some sort saying that they paid their annual visit and that they burned incense on the altar and that they confessed Caesar as Lord. So you had to have the certificate to prove that you had done what you were expected to do, and to be found without that certificate would put you at the top of the most wanted list. And so this, of course, was a difficult situation for the Christians in Smyrna. And by the way, Caesar Domitian was also known for paranoia. He was a very suspicious individual and became wary of any possible rebellion, so much so that he hired informants that he would send out to root out anybody that was refusing to submit to his rule, his authority. And of course, those informants would naturally suspect anybody without that government certificate that had been issued upon worshiping his image. That being the case, Caesar Domitian then issued a vicious persecution and investigation against the Christians in that area. Again, history tells us that there were mass executions of believers, specifically in the city of Smyrna. So this gives you a little bit of the climate in which these believers existed and kind of makes sense of the nature of the letter. And the informants that were there to help Caesar Domitian root out these Christians were none other than the Jews. And that, too, is referenced in the letter. It's interesting that it was Jewish religious folk because they were supposedly God-fearing men and women, these Jews. They were supposedly truth-loving. Truth be told, they hated the Christians more than the Gentiles did. And so Caesar made good use of them in using them as informants. And so Christians at the time that this letter is written had it rough, to say the least. They were under severe threat, kind of a threat that wearing a mask can't protect you from. No different than any of the other churches in that area. And it's interesting to me that of all the seven churches that Jesus wrote to in these two chapters, they all existed under the same tyranny. They were all facing the same issues, and yet none of them seemed to be harassed as this one was. If you read the letters, you'll know that this is the one of all seven that seems to be in the greatest trouble, the one in Smyrna. Jesus is warning them of the persecution that's coming. Needless to say that the persecution had already begun. And you got to wonder why that is. Why Smyrna, of all the seven churches? Why are they the ones that are such targets? I'd suggest to you that in any given area, this is true of us today in 2021, that in any given area of all the churches in a particular location, some are going to be more resistant to compromise than others. That's just how it is. You have that in Dunn County. You have that here in your own city. There are plenty of churches here, and the truth is some of them are more resistant to compromise than others are. Some of the seven churches to which Jesus writes were severely compromised, as we'll see if you take a read through them. But not Smyrna. If you notice, this letter stands out in the sense that there's no accusations made against them. Jesus offers them no critique, as he does in most of the other ones, where he says, this is what you're doing wrong, this is what I expect you to correct. Please do so, and do so quickly. Not Smyrna. And the reason is because there was no compromise there, or at least we have no reason to believe that there was. No spiritual compromise. And so they're being attacked. That's why that happens. And the same can be said of individual believers as much as it can be said of entire fellowships. There are going to be some Christians that are more resistant to spiritual compromise than other Christians are. And if there was ever a city in that region that would have been easier to compromise your faith, it would have been Smyrna. There was not only the constant danger of execution or persecution in that city, but there was also the enticement of the city itself and the life that it offered. It was a very enticing city. So on the one hand, you've got persecution. On the other one, you have the allurements of the world. It's been suggested that Smyrna was the most beautiful city in Asia Minor. It earned a nickname for itself, the Glory of Asia. It was the center of science, medicine, and commerce. Smyrna had schools in it. Smyrna had a stadium in it. Smyrna had multiple temples in it. So if persecution wouldn't distract you from serving Christ, then maybe intellectual interests would. Maybe health complications would. Maybe jobs, vocation, education, entertainment, false religions. It just reminds me of America. You have everything around you that tempts you to compromise your faith. So between the threats being issued against Christians and the pleasures being offered by the city, Smyrna, of all seven churches, would have been a very easy place to compromise, but they refused to do it, at least on such a scale that as a result, they lost privileges. They lost care. They lost protection, status, jobs, homes, health. They lost a lot, everything, apparently. In verse 9, where it tells us that Jesus is well aware of their poverty, the word there means abject poverty. They had nothing left. It was all being systematically taken from them, lost. Why? Because they wouldn't compromise their faith. We know that there is a cost to following Christ. We acknowledge that. But these guys were experiencing it. The only thing that they hadn't lost yet so far for their faith was their life. It's about all that they had left at this point. But for them, the cost of following Christ would require even that. Jesus is letting them know that there is going to be a great wave of persecution coming. They're going to have apparently 10 days of tribulation. Jesus is telling them to be faithful unto death, and I guess some of them are going to die, and that shouldn't be a surprise when you're living that kind of an uncompromised life, and they're on the verge of it. Now, we get that following Christ costs, but imagine receiving a letter from Jesus that says it's on the very verge now of costing you. All the theory now is history. In 10 days, it's going to hit the fan, and you're going to realize just how much it costs to follow Christ. Could you imagine getting a letter like that? Right? Return address just says Jesus. Well, they just did get a letter. And by the way, in a certain sense, and it's very true, that we just got the same letter. The last verse always ends with, "He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to who? Smyrna? No. Let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." So this is for us. This letter is for us, as they always are. Jesus introduces himself as he does in these letters. And this time, it's always different, but this time he says that he is the first and the last, he who is dead and came to life. First and last, he who is dead and came to life. Jesus is first. We'll start with that title. He calls himself first. That means preeminent. And we understand that Jesus is preeminent. The Bible says that when his work was finished, and God gave him a name that was above all other names, and that there is nothing that wasn't put beneath him except for God himself. And then, of course, in another passage, it tells us that he's equal with God anyway, so it hardly matters. That makes him top of all things, of all people, preeminent. But what's interesting about that is he's first, yes, he's preeminent first, and we get that, and that's not a stretch for our imagination to wrap its small hands around. We get that Jesus is first, but in the same breath, he also says, "I'm last." So he's not afraid to call himself first, but he's also not afraid to call himself last. "I'm the first. I am preeminent. I'm also dead last. I'm the first and the last. I'm both." And Jesus, by doing this, by living the life that he did, he sets the example, both by giving himself that title and in living the life that he did, for us to follow, in the sense that though we may be children of God, and though we may have great importance to that, and we have a privileged position in his own household, and we are priests and kings, the Bible also says that we're slaves. Jesus says, "I'm first and last." We know him as King of Kings. Why? Because he was first slave of slaves. We understand his title as King of Kings, but we don't really use that one much, do we? Slave of slaves. Jesus, slave of slaves. But he was, wasn't he? And he calls us to the same lifestyle, doesn't he? He's King of Kings, yes. He's sitting on the throne at the right hand of God, and he's in this position of great power, but only because he first stooped so low. In the book of Philippians, we're familiar with this passage, where it says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, that means slave, coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death. Going even lower than that, even the death of the cross. Therefore, that's why God has also highly exalted him and given him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, not to Caesar Domitian, but to him. Why? Because he is King of kings and Caesar's, if you will, of Caesars. Why? Because he's slave of slaves. What was the path that Jesus took on the way to such greatness? It's a path called death. Path called death. Voluntary, obedient death. And it's not the inevitable death that awaits us all, that will catch us all sooner or later, the one that we spend our lifetime trying to avoid. This is the one that we deliberately walk into because obeying God required that we go in a direction that was risky, and we decided to choose obedience over compromise. It may look a little bit different in America than it might in other countries, at least right now, but I can't guarantee that it will always be as safe to be an obedient Christian in America. They're being faced with the decision to die, and the time may come when we are as well. If anything, death to your reputation. But that's not a far reach at this point. You're going to lose clout with people that surround you. You're going to lose credibility with those whose opinions you value. You get a little too close to Jesus. You remain a little too obedient. You take your faith out of the church and into the world. You might start to find that there will be pushback, and it'll make you sweat a little bit, and there will be things to deal with. Some of you, it will be death not to your body, but to your job. Quite possible. It will be death to friends, relationships that you cherished. Some of you, it won't be death to your body, but it might mean death to your family in a certain sense. Brace yourself for that. It might not be at Christmas time like it used to be, where everybody's talking about cheery things and how's things going. They hate you now. They won't say it, but they have enmity in their mind against the God you love and worship, and your mind is at enmity with them. God put it there. It may not mean death to your body. It may mean death to playing pretend, like everything's okay in life. Jesus says, I know. I know how it goes. I know your works. I know your tribulation. I know your poverty. I get it. Works and tribulation and poverty. Those three words really encapsulate the life of a slave, do they not? Work, tribulation, and poverty. You own nothing. It's very difficult. And all you do is work. Jesus says, I know that is what your life consists of right now. Slavery. Slavery. Slavery that comes as the purchase price of faith. Slavery that could have been avoided. You didn't have to do this, but you did. You're faithful. Jesus says, I know. I know. He says, you're on the right path. You're doing the very same thing that I did. He's commending them. Why? Because their lives match his. His was one of work, tribulation, and poverty. The tribulation that he refers to here is this internal sort of tribulation. We understand that there was external persecution coming their way, probably a whole lot of external persecution and harassment that they'd already been dealing with. But this particular word speaks of internal pressure that restricts you and leaves you without options. Like you know that to obey Jesus is going to be so difficult, but you're faced with a decision that you know if you avoid, it'll probably be worse. At least in your conscience, you won't live this down. You won't be able to rest. It was like when Peter was faced with a decision to either deny Christ and perhaps live another day, or confess Christ right there around the fire and maybe die. That internal pressure, and he chose wrongly, and it didn't go well for him. It says that he went weeping bitterly. So this is a lose-lose. So welcome to the world of internal pressure that restricts you and leaves you without option. It's the slavery that we've been invited into as followers of Christ. We can either avoid the wrath of Caesar in this world by bowing to him, which would, of course, and we know this, incur the displeasure of God. Or we can avoid the displeasure of God by refusing to bow to the Caesars of this world and thus incur their wrath. Yay! So here's where I do the altar call and find out if there's any unbelievers in the room. And do you want in? Do you want to join us? Is this the life that you want? I mean, what was Jesus Christ thinking putting stuff like this in the Bible? Did he not realize that some people might accidentally read it and go, well, I don't want that then? It would hardly matter whether they read it or not, because sooner or later you're going to face it in real time. And if reading this and knowing this is what's coming is enough to make you walk away, I guarantee you will when you inevitably face it in real time. You're going to be faced with a decision that's going to cause inner turmoil, stress, tension. It's going to be risky. You might lose something, and you're going to go, I don't want it. Well, then it hardly mattered what he said in Revelation chapter 2. It's going to scare you away one way or another. But for those with this kind of faith, though there will be that inward tribulation that restricts you, it will restrict you and keep you on that path. And Jesus says, I know you're on that path, and it's a path I recognize because I walked it too. Works, tribulation, and poverty. So these Christians in Smyrna, they already counted the cost of living for Christ, which is what Jesus tells us to do, which is probably why he did put this into the Bible, so that we could look ahead and go, if it ever got to this, am I in? I hope you have those kinds of conversations with yourself. Those who don't are leaving their minds unprepared for the day when they're forced to make that decision without having had the conversational prep. They've counted the cost. Apparently, somewhere along the way, they decided that they would rather have a tortured body for obeying Jesus than a bothered conscience for not. And I sometimes wonder what I would do if it came down to it. I would encourage you to consider what you would do if it came down to it. Would you rather have a tortured body or a tortured conscience? If you had to choose between facing the wrath of Caesar right now or the displeasure, even the wrath of God later, which one would you choose? They chose the wrath of Caesar, and they were going to pay for it. And you know what? You would think that Jesus might be inclined to reward them with a peaceful life for making the right decision. Even though it was risky, even though it was a little bit frightening, they still decided to follow me. Oh, man, they're so great. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to give them a nice and easy life as a reward for having made the hard decision. But Jesus doesn't do that. He says, really, what they're going to do is they're going to get the reward of being like me and dying. There's a greater reward in that than having a peaceful life. So he says, I'm going to reward some of these people with martyrdom. That's like a high honor. Did you know that in the early church, that was considered the pinnacle of your Christian faith, was to get killed for it? Like, they held that in such high regard. And we believe, kind of in a different sort of way, that to live a peaceful and easy life where you get everything you want and can enjoy the world and heaven too, that's the great reward. I'm not saying one's right and the other one's wrong. I'm just saying, man, we've changed. Somewhere along the way, we changed. You notice he transitions a little bit. He says, I know your works, tribulation, and poverty. But then in parentheses, if you got King James, New King James, I think ESV is in parentheses, ASV and ASB. There's a bunch of them There's a parenthetical insertion here where he says, I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you're rich. Like, hey, just wanted to throw that in there. And we need to understand that when these words are written in Scripture, it's not necessarily this sort of parenthetical insertion that was made by translators, you know, just to kind of set us straight. This isn't John's opinion. This is actually in the original text as a matter of fact specified by Jesus himself. He's saying, you on the outward appear to be living in abject poverty with nothing to your name, but I can see through the veneer and I know that you're rich. You're rich in a way that no one else can recognize but me. By all outward appearances, these folks in Smyrna looked very, very poor on many levels. Jesus doesn't see it that way. He sees them as rich. Riches that have been acquired by these people through faithful diligence. They've acquired more riches than they realize. They don't even realize how rich they are. That's why Jesus is telling them. Because when you're in a situation like that and life is crumbling all around you, and then you get a letter in the mail that says you're about to die, doesn't feel very rich. And Jesus is going, hang on to the very end. You've got 10 days left. You'll finish well. Die in faith. You're richer than you know. You're on the verge of cashing in a lot of really expensive chips. This is going to go well for you in the end. You're rich. Hang on. You're rich. Hang on. Well, Jesus can see it not just because he's Jesus. We get that Jesus has divine insight and can see all things. So he sees it for that reason. But he also can see how rich they are because he has personal experience, right? This is the same path that he went down, and he was richly rewarded for his faith. Jesus had faith. When his work was finished, and it was difficult work, and he ended up dying, but when his was finished, he was given a name above all other names. He was given a seat at the right hand of God the Father, and all glory and honor has been given to the Son. So he sees these people in Smyrna and says, you're rich and you don't get it. I do. Stay the course. That's what we need to hear when life gets difficult. We don't always need to hear, oh, it'll get better. Oh, I'll pray for you. Things will turn out different. I know it's just a rough patch, and maybe it is. And maybe you should pray for that individual. But it might not get better. Not in the sense that we would like it to get better. Sometimes Christianity has a way of taking you deeper and deeper and deeper instead of one day plateauing, and it's like, oh, there. Whew. Jesus would say to us, who are going deeper and deeper and deeper as we follow him, he would say to us, hang on, you're acquiring great riches for your faith. Don't compromise now. Don't do it now. And then he brings up this group that were perennial thorns in the sides of the Christians in all of Asia Minor and elsewhere, but particularly there in Smyrna. He says, I know the blasphemy of those who say that they're Jews but aren't. They're of the synagogue of Satan, he says. They're of the synagogue of Satan. Jesus, again, is able to see things that no one else can. And when he looks at this particular group that seems ultra-religious, very God-fearing, probably good people, this camp of Jews, he sees something different. He says, though they go to synagogue, they're worshiping Satan. Okay? So not all Satanists look like Satan worshipers. Or I could say not all Satan worshipers are Satanists. These guys were doing no favors for the believers in Smyrna. They were opposed to them. They were in league with all of the powers of the world, the most evil and wicked of them. And yet they worshiped God. Doesn't make sense to me. Doesn't make sense to Christ. He says they're not. They're of the synagogue of Satan. And Jesus says, I know. In other words, he's not surprised. He said, I know what's going on. Happens even now in the church, whether we're in a synagogue or a church, I'll tell you that this always has been an issue and it always will be an issue. Jesus has been watching this rerun ever since Smyrna, and it happens even now. True Christians in our day and age have to deal with the slander that's offered by false Christians. There's always the spots in the love feasts that are to be dealt with. They pretend fidelity to the cause of Christ. They pretend loyalty to God. They pretend love for Christ, but they have no problem climbing into bed with the world if it serves their purposes. And in the end, if the day comes and we're alive to see it, that persecution sweeps across the United States, I can tell you with a fair amount of certainty that some of the greatest trouble believers are going to face will come from within the church, from the false Christians that have been stationed there by the devil. Just like has happened here, there will be informants. There will be some in any God-ordained church who, when things become too risky and difficult to remain an uncompromised Christian, will begin to capitulate to the pressures of the secular world, and in order to cover themselves, will rat out those in their own fellowship who are still uncompromised. This is what was happening in Smyrna. And it was these Jews that Jesus refers to who were doing it. So there are those who serve the devil's purposes, but faithfully attend church, because that's where the devil wants them. And he wants them there because that's where he can best use them. The devil isn't stupid, and it's good strategy, really, if you can get your informants where the best information is kept and where the greatest work is being done. And so he stations his own within the fellowship of God's people. It's not unlike him to sow tares among the wheat, right? And this is no indictment on anybody in particular here, but do you suppose that it might actually be happening here? It's quite likely. They act like Christians, they talk like Christians, they think like Christians, but they serve the devil's purposes. And the devil himself, sees to it that they find their way in. They find Christian churches because that's where they're meant to be. They plant themselves among the true believers until a day when they finally manifest their true nature and they inflict as much damage as they possibly can. And there's no worship more satisfying to the devil than that. That's how he is worshipped. Okay, and he finds it very satisfying. In fact, there's, at the time of the writing of this letter, roughly 95 A.D., in the church was a man named Polycarp. He would have been young at the time. He was John's disciple. He ends up becoming one of the church's first and finest leaders, aside of the apostles. He was ministering at Smyrna starting at about this time. Some 60 years later, he would be martyred himself, burned at the stake. So this letter comes, and he's there to hear it read aloud in the church. And his day is coming, though it takes a while. But church history records how he was burned alive at the stake in 155 A.D., and guess who it was that carried the wood to the burn pile? It was these Jews, the informants, if you will. And it was here 60 years prior that Jesus was telling him and others within the fellowship that it was going to happen, and tells them not to be afraid. Don't worry about it. Okay, you're telling me that we're going to die. And then don't be afraid. Fear not, he says. Don't fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. That seems just so impractical. Right? This is like going to the doctor for a CT scan and then the tests come back and you've got 10 days to live. I mean, whoa, talk about a bad liver. But don't be afraid. I mean, don't be afraid. We're going to die. I'm going to die. And you're just, it sounds so nonchalant. Trite. Unconcerned. Like, don't be afraid, huh? Yeah, don't. Old Polycarp took this to heart when he was brought to the stadium to die naked in front of a full house. Polycarp's guards prepared to nail him to the stake. And if you're familiar with what happened next, it's incredible. He turns to those that held the nails and he calmly said, "Just leave me as I am, because the one who gives me strength to endure the fire will also give me strength to remain at the stake unmoved without being secured by nails. I'm not afraid." He told me 60 years ago that I needn't be afraid. And I'm going to prove to the world, I'm going to prove to this stadium full of onlookers, I'm going to prove to myself, and I'm going to prove to the church in Menominee 2021 that when Jesus says, "Don't be afraid," you don't need to be afraid. And history tells us that he offered a psalm of praise and thanksgiving to God as his captors ignited the wood. There you go. Polycarp took Jesus' command to heart, and he lived it out in front of an unbelieving audience. We've all been called to do that. Take God's commands to heart and live them out in front of an unbelieving audience. Some of them are easier than others, but none of it exempts us from the responsibility of doing so. It's impossible for us to see how trivial suffering and death actually are until you face them bravely. Did you catch what I said? It's impossible to see how trivial suffering and death actually are until you face them bravely. Then you'll see how trivial they actually are. Suffering, death, face them bravely and you'll see that they weren't worth fearing like we did. Hebrews chapter 2 verse 14 and 15 says that Jesus died to free us from the fear of death that held us captive all our lives. Wouldn't it be nice one day to face death with the kind of bravery that Polycarp did? Terminal illness? No problem. I've been living my life in good faith up until now. Why would I change anything? I'm on my way to glory. I'm on my way to paradise. I'm on the verge of an extended vacation that is beyond anything that the world could offer. Why would I fear? And yet we do. And Jesus says, "You can stop now." As long as we, as Christians, continue to allow fear to dictate our approach to serving Christ, we'll never serve him to the fullest because there will always be that fear acting as a restraint. This happens even now to some of us, even though we don't yet live in a persecuted country or city like Smyrna. Jesus says, "Be faithful to death." Fear will never let you do that. Jesus says, "Be faithful unto death." Fear is always going to get in the way of that. That's fear's objective, to keep you from living like Jesus wants. Fear's objective is to keep you from living like Jesus wants and dying like Jesus did. So instead of being faithful to death, you'll be faithful until it starts to hurt. But Jesus didn't say, "Be faithful until it hurts." He said, "Be faithful to death." Some of us, we're only faithful till it hurts. We're only faithful until it requires us to talk to people, or we're only faithful until it disrupts our schedule or interferes with our future. Well, if we let that happen now, then we're not being sufficiently prepared to die for Christ. No one's going to die for Christ who isn't currently living for him. And Jesus is giving us opportunities to punch through difficulty with faith and prepare us for the next round of difficulty, that we might punch through that with equal faith and keep going. If it ends in death, it ends in death. It may or may not. We haven't been promised that it will, unlike these here. The only way to go the full distance with Christ is to stop fearing what you'll lose if you do. And you will lose a lot. You will lose a lot, if not all. And Jesus isn't trying to hide that from them nor from us. He's just trying to let us know that, hey, whatever you do lose for him, it's going to be tiny compared to what you'd gain, even if it is your life. That's why he says, fear not. Don't worry about it. You won't lose anything in following Christ that you won't be handsomely compensated for in the end. He talks about the second death. He says, be faithful unto death. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. Now, the second death is something that we ought to fear. He's saying, only by not fearing the first death will you avoid the second one. So let's give our fear to something worthy of it. This second death is a very all-encompassing death. The first death is physical. The second death is spiritual and physical. The first death is when your body is put into a grave and they say a prayer and go home. The second death is when your body and your soul are thrown into the lake of fire. Revelation chapter 20 talks about that. And Jesus told us along the way, he said, don't fear man that can kill your body, fear God that can kill your body and your soul. He's referring to the second death there. We need not be controlled by fear. We need not be controlled by fear. If we could only take his command seriously, fear not, don't be afraid. Refusing to be controlled by fear was how the gospel got started. That's how it gained traction in the world. A bunch of guys, I shouldn't even say a bunch, it was relatively few. A few faithful individuals refused to be held back by fear, and we have them to thank here on this side of the world. We're here because of their bravery. We're here, we're going to heaven because of somebody else's courage. The gospel came this far because other people were not afraid to die. He says, I'll give you the crown of life. This is a crown that is a victor's crown for those who didn't love their lives so much that they were afraid to die. They didn't let their fear in any respect stop them from honoring and obeying Jesus. They had victory there, so they were given a crown of life, which is a victor's crown. It's also a royal crown because, again, those who decide to suffer for Christ, with Christ, like slaves, will be given the privilege of reigning with Christ like a king. That's also dealt with in Revelation. But there's honor in this. He's giving us an opportunity, like he's giving those in Smyrna the opportunity to live a life that will be honored when it's done. Is that what you want out of life? Sure it is. I want that. I'm sure that you want that. I want my life to count, and so do you. But we also want this world's goods, and sometimes they conflict. We sometimes want this world's accolades and praise and respect, and sometimes they conflict. Sometimes we want temporary glory and partial honor, and sometimes that conflicts with God's promise of eternal glory and honor. We can pursue either one, but sometimes it's either or. And whichever one you choose to pursue, whether it be the temporal life in this world or the eternal one in the afterlife, either one's going to cost you dearly. They're about to find that out. The term Smyrna, as far as the city name is concerned, is interesting because the root word of Smyrna is myrrh. And if you know anything about myrrh, you know that it was brought to Jesus at the beginning of his life and he was embalmed with it at the end of his life. It's an organic compound that was used as an incense. It had a sweet-smelling fragrance, and they would use it to embalm dead bodies. It's a fitting symbol in relation to Christ's life, as well as the church in Smyrna here. because, as I said, it was a sweet-smelling fragrance, but in order for it to be fully utilized as an incense, in order for it to release its fragrance, it had to be cut and crushed and burned. Very graphic depiction of the life of Christ and the lives of those who follow him, as the citizens of Smyrna were doing. Cut, crushed, and burned. So if it isn't destroyed, it's really not serving its purpose. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12 tells us that suffering is what every Christian is called to in some measure. And if we're not willing to volunteer ourselves to it, then we're not serving our full and true purpose. Anyone who desires to live a godly life can expect a certain amount of suffering. And so to truly follow Christ is to walk in the same path that he did, one that begins with suffering and slavery. That's the portion we live right now. But it will one day end with kingship and a crown worn by those, only by those, who decide to die. And I'll leave you with an account that comes from Christian history. It tells us about a situation that arose in a communist country once upon a time. The record tells us that these Christians were together singing choruses when two soldiers entered with rifles. The service came to a halt as the Russian soldiers stared at the believers with wild eyes. "What are you doing here?" they shouted. "Worshipping your imaginary God?" And the church members cowered in the pews, wondering if there were more soldiers and more guns outside. "All those who are faithful to God move to the right side of the church," said one of the soldiers. His face was a mask of hatred. "You will be shot for your faith. You who wish to go home and keep your life, stand on the left side. You have to decide to live or to die." Those who are faithful to this God will die. Those who deny him can live freely. Now, 10 minutes earlier, everyone had sung praises equally. Now it was a question of life or death. Some stood to the left, looking sadly or waving apologetically at those on the right. Some stood on the right. Their eyes were closed in last-minute prayer. "You on the left are free to go," one of the soldiers said moments later. Those people filed out, taking one last look at those who would soon be dead. And when only those on the right remained, the soldiers put down their weapons and said, "We're Christians too. We just wanted to worship without hypocrites." Dang, right? Miss the opportunity to prove something to God and to yourself and to the world, and in a flash it was over, and now I missed it. Even if they would have been shot in the head, it would have been over in an instant. You don't want to miss opportunities that Christ orchestrates for you in your life to lose something of value, because it'll be given back. He's promised that it will be given back 100-fold. And yet, if you're like me, is the temptation not real strong to sometimes in that situation go, what would you do right now? The whole church is stormed, people with guns, and we're forced to choose right now on the spot. Don't you wonder, well, what would I have done? We can know what we would have or will do if we're ever in a position based upon what we're doing right now when we're faced with smaller ones. Life is a series of decisions, compromises or non-compromises. Life is a series. You're going to keep going in faith, or is this the time where you tap out and you're done? And I'm telling you, if you're in a spot right now where you're about to lose something that's precious to you because going forward with Christ means you're on the cusp of seeing wonderful things. You're also on the cusp of living the rest of your life with shame and regret. This is decision time. This is decision time. Would you decide to die if you were faced with a very concrete decision? If it was as black and white as it was on the last page of my notes, would you decide to die? Let your life reflect that. Being willing to die for Christ is nothing new. And neither is denying him in order to live. Nothing new. People do it all the time. What's the difference? What's the difference between being a person who's willing to die for Christ or that individual who's going to deny him in order to live? What's the difference between the two? Well, let me ask you this. Is it any wonder that Jesus, chronologically, as he writes to these churches, confronts the church in Ephesus about their love for him before he gets around to challenging the church in Smyrna to die for him? Do you think that love and uncompromising obedience have anything to do with each other? Do you think that Jesus would address the issue of lovelessness and coldness in you before he would ever face you with the decision to actually sacrifice for him? Because if we don't love him, we're not gonna. If our love is growing cold, that's why we're compromising. He deals with Ephesus. Then he sets his sights on Smyrna and says, it's time to die, and I know that you're ready for it because, unlike Ephesus, you love me, and you love me dearly. Now it's time to prove it to the very end. Would you do that? You know, I come down last time and dealt with Ephesus and called into question the love that we have for Christ. We're doing that all over again now, aren't we? Because if we don't love him, we just aren't going to walk very far with him. Even if we get a good 5 years under our belt. I walked with him for 10 years, 20 years. Doesn't matter. You won't walk with him to the very end if you don't have love. Because why? Only those with love will lay down their life for a friend. Is Jesus your friend? Yeah. Then would you lay your life down for him? Yeah. Then if he calls you to die, you will. If he calls you to a life of loss, you'll accept it. If he calls you to deny or to lay down the things that are precious, you'll walk away. Are we doing that today? Will we do it tomorrow? Let's pray.